All right, starting in verse 25. From the issuing of the decree, and that was the decree by Artaxerxes I in March 445 B.C., our reference was Nehemiah 2, 1 through 5. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One, the Messiah, the ruler comes, there will be seven sevens, that's 49 prophetic years, and 62 sevens, an additional 434 prophetic years, making a total of 483 prophetic years. It, Jerusalem, will be rebuilt, which we discussed took 49 years, over the first 49 years, with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. Verse 26. After 62 sevens, 483 years, in making the needed lunar solar leap year adjustments, this comes out to be AD 32. The Anointed One, the Messiah, will be violently cut off, and will have nothing, violently cut off, but not for himself, but for others. The people of the pagan ruler who will come, the soldiers of Titus Vespasianus in 70 AD, will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end, now focusing on the last days, will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and desolations have been decreed. Verse 27, he, the Antichrist, will confirm a covenant. And Reggie wanted to make an adjustment to this. Confirm a covenant, not necessarily an established mandated peace accord, but a confirming of the covenant God has with Israel.
That is to say, a covenant that's already in place. He, instead of making a firm covenant, he makes firm a covenant. He gives sanction, or he causes it to prevail, as one Hebrew rendering.
Yes.
So he actually gives a confirmation, just like it says, but it's like the way we would use the word English to confirm something. It's already existing, and the part of the evidence for that is we see this covenant appear again in Daniel 11. Clearly in relationship to the Antichrist, because the Antichrist is seen waging an assault on what's called the Holy Covenant. So it has to do with the people and the land, and particularly the city of Jerusalem. See what I mean?
I'm sorry. The Antichrist will confirm God's covenant with Israel?
That's right. There two things are going on here at once. Here's the paradox. You know, here is mystery. There is a human side to this. It's a covenant. On the one hand, it's a covenant with death and hell. And it's a league made with this deceitful man. On the other side, he is giving a pretentious confirmation, a recognition of the Holy Covenant, that this is Israel's land. So he is actually ratifying, or you know, giving the Jews are depending on his approval.
And without that approval, the temple cannot be rebuilt, correct?
Yes, and the temple, while we've already talked about this, it's not sanctified in the sense of the Jewish people. It is nonetheless where God has put his name. And it's the city of Jerusalem and the holy things and the holy places that this man comes to desolate and trod underfoot, right? So that is a holy covenant, the ancient covenant that God made with Abraham. Luke chapter 1, I think, where it says, to thy holy covenant. And he was talking about, what was he talking about? Simeon said that you would serve God without fear all the days of your life in this land. So the issue of the land is part of this covenant. He's giving formal recognition.
Lip service, so to speak.
Totally, because he's not, at the very same time, we'll see this in Daniel 11, at the very same time he's giving an outward confirmation and approval of this, he's plotting in his heart and forecasting his devices. He's having secret intelligence with others that with him hate this covenant. So on the one hand, the covenant is holy. And on the other hand, it's a league made with him. And it is a covenant with death and hell, because the Jews are trusting in this man, which is really just to say they're trusting in themselves, which is God's ancient contention with them. They're trusting in the flesh. So it's a mystery here that this is at once and at the same time a wicked, perverse agreement. It's doomed. It's a deception and a delusion. But it has the pretense of this wicked, vile man of confirming something holy.
There's a lot of historical precedence for that right now, because several emphatic declarations have been made lately by people like Mahmoud Abbas that he will never recognize the Jewish nature of Israel. And so if Antichrist was going to establish a covenant between the current actors now, he would say, okay, Mahmoud Abbas, you have to recognize the Jewish nature of Israel.
Absolutely.
That'll be part of the covenant.
That's right.
Okay, we'll do it.
And all the while plotting against it,
right, exactly.
Hating it, despising it, right. And uniting the Islamic world in their hatred against it. But the Jews are deluded and think this guy's okay with it all. He's got their back. He doesn't have their back.
Because their version of despising the shame.
Right, right.
So, in other words, it's a covenant with death and Sheol because of who they make it with.
Right, exactly.
The covenant itself
is holy.
Is holy. Okay.
And because I urge on commentators not to miss the issue of the Antichrist, the flood, the covenant. All this is going to be seen again in Daniel 11. And I'm a real stickler for staying with the context within the book itself.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, bringing in, importing an entirely foreign interpretation and turn around over here in another chapter and find the precise same language allegedly referring to something entirely different, events hundreds of years apart. That's not the way I'm geared, exegetically, hermeneutically, I mean.
Another thing to watch for in the days ahead is there's a very central concept in Islamic Sharia law called hudna, which means a covenant, amazingly enough. This Sharia law does not permit the Islamic community to make a covenant with anyone that's not Muslim for more than 10 years. And it also gives them provision to break it at any time, whenever it's convenient for the sake of the Islamic community.
That is fact. That is absolute. I've heard that. And they actually have in their, not the Quran itself, but in their, you know, theological support for it, an absolute advocacy for the legitimacy of lying to your enemy. So this is totally par for the course. And if we're not here for a generalized prophecy conference. We're more obviously focused on Daniel. I don't want to distract, but there's so much evidence in Scripture. I could give you guys several verses and chapters to read that show that this is going to center around the ancient enmity between Jew and Arab, particularly because these are the Semitic brothers that go all the way back to the quarrel that began in Abraham's tents. And I absolutely am one that believes that this is a regional, local little horn that rises up and becomes strong with a small people. It wouldn't surprise me if it was the Palestinian people. I didn't say, I'm not on record, you know, not thus saith the Lord, but as a tentative inference, that there's a lot to commend that view. He starts and gains public support. He could even be one of the early leaders of a newly formed Palestinian state. I don't know that. It's just, we're talking about a little horn, a Johnny come lately to the region, and then because of a power vacuum up north, he comes into what's called the greatness of the kingdom. So he moves from a very obscure origin up into, and I believe he does it in that Arab part of the world, especially among those who have an especial hatred against this covenant. And there's all kinds of indirect evidence we could cite on that. But the issue of the everlasting hatred that exists, that goes all the way back, is certainly in future context. It had to do with the day of the Lord, Israel's iniquity having an end, the final calamity, the final sudden expulsion from the land, and the Jews in flight. And while they're trying to escape the land, their ancient brother, the Palestinian in this case, it talks about Edom and Moab, they're actually grabbing Jews. It says it, you can read it. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But they're actually arresting Jews in their effort to escape and turning them back over to someone called the extortioner, which is just another name for the Antichrist. So this is a drama that is so amazingly agreeable to what we see in the current trends. And I think we're going way off out of the way if we're looking to some Western European. I think it's going to be someone probably from that ancient enmity that will make this covenant. I really believe we're looking at the Islamic world. I know that a lot of people have a problem with that. But I really believe, and at very least, what we know this much, whether or not this man is himself a leader in the Islamic world, he is at least able by every... But, you know, we're able, obviously, to see that he's able to marshal the hatred of the Islamic world against Israel and utilize that to his ends. That much we can see clearly. And I would infer further and say that this man is able to seduce the Muslim world, that he is Allah in the flesh. That's my personal conviction. Persuasion. I don't say conviction. Let me qualify that. I gravitate that way. We're talking about, and the reason I'm saying this is because even if I'm wrong, it's worth a suggestion to you, because everyone is locking in on this Western European Roman or papal dictator, whatever. And they're not looking in the very region and the very relationships that all the ancient prophecies seem to show. It goes in that direction. This would line right up with what we see in Ezekiel and in Obadiah and Psalm 83. There's 10 nations mentioned in Psalm 83. They're the ancient enemies of Israel, and they're all those very immediately surrounding Arab lands of today.
The borders of the nations have changed over the centuries. So
people groups that are still around the continent.
Not the people groups, but the borders
right.
of the lands. So, we can't like.
No, I'm not being exact. I don't know which of the 10, but I would say I'm more, for my reading and my impressions from other scriptures that correspond to what we're talking about here. If we're looking for the origin of the Antichrist, I'm not looking personally. I'm not looking in Western Europe. I'm looking in the region that's so hotly contested right now around Israel.
Yes.
Okay, well, let's continue the review, and then we're going to be getting to the covenant and a lot more details of the covenant when we get to chapter 11.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but if you could help me out here, they're actually, you're recognizing a gap between that 69th week and the 70th.
Yeah,
70th.
Yes, right.
You've actually got two gaps.
Okay.
One is the gap to the coming of the Antichrist, which starts when he confirms the covenant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which starts that 70th week.
Mm-hmm.
But the other is a gap to the city and the temple destroyed.
Right, right.
And the reason I mention that is that is specifically listed here,
mm-hmm.
and yet the timing is not accounted for in Scripture. So.
Well, that's... I don't know if you want to answer that, Phil, but if you look at our chart here, you see the cross of Christ. You've got to go, and this is why I think they're pretty hard-pressed who want to make a great deal of light about a gap, because in any view, be it the amillennial view or the premillennial view, on any view and on any reckoning, you've got to go outside of this 70 weeks to have the destruction of Jerusalem. And if you make Christ the one that takes away the sacrifice, I think that's a great error. But if you do, you've still got a gap, because because Jerusalem wasn't destroyed for another 36 more years, 40 years. And here's the point. But if we understand the destruction of Jerusalem, which clearly happens, like our brother says, a gap outside of this, and we do regard that as a fulfillment of Scripture, but only in a typical way. The future desolation of Jerusalem, which is still future from that time, actually is in the middle of the week. So if we take that as only a type and not the exhaustive final fulfillment, then really the destruction of Jerusalem that we're speaking about, that's going to bring on the last desolation, that destruction happens within the middle of the last week. And in that sense, if this is a mere type, then you're not talking about anything that's... There's still continuity. Everything particular to this vision is within this 70 weeks.
You're talking about a sentence which is a type that actually historically happened.
It's certainly historical. So we're going to talk about Antiochus Epiphanes.
That's all right. I don't want to derail this.
Well, gaps, we got them everywhere. We got them between the Roman Empire. You've got them with Antiochus Epiphanes. There's going to be gaps in the book of Daniel. That's part of what we're wrestling with, a mystery here. And that's part of what has made commentators actually take types and make them the exhaustive fulfillment and say maybe something will happen in the future that's sort of like... And they're not interested in the details. They're interested in broad strokes. And we're saying every detail of this prophecy has got to be fulfilled and accounted for. There's too much in antiquity that cannot be accounted for, that do not answer to the particulars. And even teachers that don't even have our view grant us that much. They say, hey, we're having a trouble having this fit. Now, certainly, without contest, the destruction of Jerusalem happened in 70 AD. But the destruction of Jerusalem and the age-long dispersion of the Jews was not particularly clearly seen in the Old Testament. It's only come to light with the fulfillment. But what was clearly seen in the Old Testament was a future last 3.5 years that starts when Jerusalem is, when this covenant's violated. There's a final destruction and desolation of Jerusalem that ends in the return of Christ and the resurrection. That is clear. The other is, it has to be a type. As sure as there's a future abomination, here's our argument. As surely as the abomination didn't happen in 70 AD, and there's such a case for that, then so surely we have to understand there's a future destruction of Jerusalem. So therefore, the final destruction of Jerusalem cannot be in 70 AD. There's got to be another destruction of Jerusalem. So if we find a gap, we have to make a gap.
And that's why we read from Zechariah 14 this morning. The city will be taken.
Captured. And so on. And the whole, Old Testament sees Jerusalem in desolation when the Lord returns. Oh, it's everywhere. Every prophet talks about it at length.
Okay, back to the paraphrase. Just to wrap this up. So the Antichrist will confirm a covenant or make firm a covenant with many for 1-7, the last piece of prophetic time, the last 7 years, a period of grave tribulation, which the focus of that grave tribulation is the last 3.5 years of that. But in the middle of the seven, after 3.5 years, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And just as Antiochus Epiphanes and Titus Vespucianus did before him, and on a wing of the rebuilt end-time temple, is this one translation, he, the Antichrist, will set up an abomination that causes desolation, a false god, or an image, until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. And that is until this man of sin is destroyed by the brightness of Jesus' coming, and he, the Messiah, shall reign forever and ever. Now, this will be clarified more as we get to Daniel chapter 11. But let's turn the page, and you've got in front of you Daniel the prophet, the final vision.